I call this meeting of the Jordan House Health and Human Service Policy Committee and the Education Policy Committee to order. So today we have a presentation from the Department of Health along with the Department of Department of Education. And from Education Minnesota. Before we begin the hearing, I just want to express that I know within the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy, one of the things I have talked about, even within my opening statement, is really the amount of money that we're spending on health and human services to only see often enough not great outcomes. We have huge disparities within that system. And so today, my hope is that within this presentation, we will learn some information about ACEs, adverse experiences. And through that presentation, my hope is that it will help us to look at how we are creating policies that create practices that are utilized back out in the community so that we can begin to see an investment in the dollars that we are spending within health and human services, within mental health, within many of the departments that we see that we are just spending a huge amount of money and not really getting the outcomes that we could get or should get. So, and I think that can also not only support the work that we do in health and human services, but also support the work that we need to do within our educational systems. And so with that, I would ask the Minnesota Department of Health, Joan Brent, to come forward. And if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you are and begin your presentation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joan Brandt. I'm the Division Director for Child and Family Health at MDH. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about ACEs, or Adverse Childhood Experiences. By way of a little background, the first ACEs study was done in 1997 by the CDC in conjunction with Kaiser Permanente in California. It was really the very first study to begin that to link adverse childhood experiences to health outcomes later in life. The ACE score is simply a count of the number of categories of ACEs that each person reported, anywhere from 0 to 10. And you all received the very back page of the Minnesota report has the ACEs studies, or the ACEs quiz, so you can see what the questions are. As the ACE score goes up, the risk for various lifelong health problems goes up. As these studies advanced, CDC allowed states to embed ACEs questions into the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, or the BRFIS study. So Minnesota took this on in their 2011 BRFIS study and then released a report in 2013, and that's what you have available to you. My presentation today is built on those findings, along with additional studies that have been done since then that look at risk, resilience, and ways that we can best support our families and communities. Over the past 10 years, the information around brain science has really expanded our understanding significantly, particularly as we think about brain development in childhood. Some of you may have had the chance to hear Dr. Megan Gunner a few weeks ago talk about brain development, so some of this will be repeat, but then we'll talk more specifically about ACEs and how that affects lifelong course. We know from brain science how relationships and experiences prenatally through adolescence can influence our lifelong health and social outcomes. We're born with billions of neurons, trillions of synaptic interconnections. During our first 1,100 days of life, the brain is developing and forming the neural pathways at its most rapid rate of the entire life course. So those first 3 years of life are so key in the development of the brain. While genes are responsible for basic architecture of the brain, there's just not enough genetic information to prescribe the final wiring, so our earliest experiences and environment actually shape the architecture of our brain. And our brains develop through the relationships and environments in which we are surrounded. When brain development in infants and young children is fully supported, they're more likely to reach their milestones critical to future individual and community success, Success like kindergarten readiness, third grade reading proficiency, high school graduation and post-secondary education, gainful employment, lifetime physical and mental health and well-being, and the avoidance of substance use, abuse, and crime. Our development is, brain development is affected and shaped by our experiences, and our relationships define those experiences. I've got a short little video to share with you. I might need help getting it started. Thank you. Thank you.
We've long known that what happens to us in childhood can leave a lasting imprint on the adults we become. The places we live, the people we know, the best of times, and the worst. They all somehow become part of us. Now, a new science is telling us that our experiences go even deeper than we thought. It happens on the genetic level. Experiences, scientists have learned, can leave chemical marks on our DNA. Those marks can switch genes on or off, changing the way our bodies and our brains function. The changes can prime us to thrive, or they can impede development, affecting health and well-being for life.
We're talking about processes here that are at a biological level. It just gets under the skin in a variety of ways.
These chemical tags are set in place during critical periods of biological change.
There's these special vulnerabilities in utero during pregnancy, in infancy, in early childhood.
Everything in an infant's experience can help or hinder. Diet, environmental toxins, housing, safety, even the parent's stress levels. These new discoveries have profound social and political implications. Because if social influences can alter the way our genes work, then early environments can result in biological obstacles to success.
The poorest kids in our society, not surprisingly, are the most vulnerable to just about every health outcome we can measure. These are really healthy young children who, with time, are going to suffer the consequences of their social class.
New evidence shows that social and economic stressors can affect children in infancy, causing changes in gene expression, changes that may last a lifetime.
It affects their way of thinking, it affects their views of themselves, it affects their social relationships.
But along with a new understanding of how early experience influences development, this science brings hope. Improved social conditions, the evidence shows, can actually provide the biological foundation for lives that are healthier and more likely to thrive.
The science is clear about this. What we need is for the policy to follow the science and get us to more protective environments for children.
So the point of the video, and thank you very much, appreciate it. We adapt to our environment. We are built to adapt, whether it's nurturing or hostile. The environment that we live in actually impacts, as you saw in the video, our chemical and structural makeup of our brains, especially the brains as it develops in early childhood. About 80% of brain development actually occurs during early childhood. That's not to say all brain development, that it's done by the time you're 3 years old. We know we're learning all the time new things about brain science, and right now they're saying that brains continue to develop till about the age of 25. I don't know that that won't change. The environment that we live in certainly shapes who we become. It becomes problematic when the skills and behaviors don't line up with our environment or the social expectations. So critical brain development windows are early childhood and adolescence. Infant mental health is essential to develop the capacity of the infant and toddler to form close and secure relationships, experience, regulate, and express emotions, and explore their environment and learn. This development is done in the context of their family, the community, and the cultural experiences for young children that are provided. Their relationships define those experiences. We know that not all stress is bad. There's normal everyday stress, like driving home in a snowstorm last night. We learn how to cope with that when we are surrounded by the right things in our lives. There's also acute stress, where such as a family divorce, where it happens, and we adapt to that change or that stress in our lives, but we do it because there are things around us, the resources, we can draw on the resources to support us. There's also toxic stress, which is overwhelming stress that activates our stress response systems and actually changes our brain makeup. The experience of something as toxic stress is relative to the relationships that we have available to us. Relationships can act as a buffer to the stress. Even in serious trauma, the presence, if there's close nurturing relationships and supports, children can overcome those difficulties. And other stressors can create a toxic environment more readily when a child doesn't have a relationship to create that buffer for them. Adverse childhood experiences are just one source of toxic stress. These include family stressors such as parental substance abuse, mental illness, incarceration, divorce, and abuse. Incarceration is the number one ACE for children within Minnesota. The social conditions and aspects of our neighborhoods, workplaces, faith communities, and social policies can also be a source of toxic stress. So if you have familial stress, and that's and you don't have social buffers within the family, and then you also are surrounded by a community that has stressors within the community, you kind of have a double whammy for the child, because they just don't have community or family to draw upon. So examples of community toxic stress are things like food deserts, childcare deserts, neighborhood violence, racism, high rates of unemployment. Those are all things that cause more stress to the family and then therefore create stress for the child as well. Negative social conditions also contribute to the prevalence of adverse childhood experiences. There's lots of examples that we can share. In this study, specifically, it's a longitudinal study that demonstrated that poverty contributed to higher frequency symptoms of mental illness. This study was done in 2003, so we have a long history of knowing that there's a relationship between poverty and mental health. What they found was that it actually came down to parent time constraints, which accounted for about 77% of the increased symptoms of mental illness due to poverty. There's also things like housing instability, which we can see increases the rate of depression and anxiety due to disruptions. If you're moving frequently or you don't have a place to stay, you don't have a community to surround you and provide the social supports that you need, as well as it disrupts scheduled childhood routines, and it decreases your access to things like health care. The risk of experiencing toxic stress isn't exclusive to one part of Minnesota. As you can see from this map, economic, health, and family stability factors are equally distributed across the state. There's an undeniable relationship between social determinants of health and ACEs. They're mutually reinforcing. Toxic stress impacts lifelong social and health outcomes and early death if it's unmitigated. So we know that toxic stress leads to chronic health conditions and can contribute to early death if there isn't some kind of disruption to that those stressors in life. The ACE research definitively links toxic stress and trauma in childhood and a wide range of health and social outcomes throughout the lifespan. We know how this happens. We know that the pathway or mechanism, starting with the biological and brain changes, are disrupted and can lead to things like social, emotional, and cognitive impairment. More than about 50, so as we look at some of the numbers related to ACEs, in Minnesota specifically, we know that more than 55% of all Minnesotans have at least one ACE in their history. So back to, we know that ACEs are very common across all populations. But if we dig a little deeper, what's clear from the research is that the more sources of toxic stress a person has, the more likely they are to have poor life outcomes. It's the pileup of stressors that matter. So if you look at ACEs here, we know that for each additional childhood trauma a person reports, they're more likely to experience poor health. You can see here that 36% of people with five or more ACEs report experiencing depression, and the same is true for anxiety. And if we look across many chronic health conditions, it's true, asthma, diabetes, obesity, the pattern holds true for a wide range of health conditions. We know that being exposed to a high dose of childhood adversity dramatically increases the risk for 7 of the 10 leading causes of death in the U.S. In Minnesota, we also looked at the social factors and found that those experiencing the conditions of things like less than high school education, they never married, they were unemployed, didn't own a home, worried about where their mortgage was going to come from, or worried about buying food. Those are all things that contribute to five or more ACEs in people who have had more than one ACE in their lifetime or in their childhood. So the implications of ACEs include health and social factors. With a pileup of toxic stress, there's more likely to have poor social outcomes. The cycle continues. We see that the connection between the community and individual is essential for parents to be able to provide support to their children and decrease the child stress levels. Neighborhoods and housing, schools, food, violence are all kinds of things that certainly impact a parent's ability to engage in the important activities that promote brain development, what we call serve and return. If a parent's worried about where they're going to live that night or where the food is going to come from for the next week, it makes it a lot harder for them to engage in a relationship with their child. If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those basic needs, food, shelter, housing, are important. You've got to get those filled first before you can move on to things like social connections and bonding. So, and those are essential activities for a child, for the parent to be able to engage with them. We also see that discrimination impacts the number of ACEs that people report. As you can see from this slide, the number of ACEs is significant within the African American and American Indian populations. This certainly leads us to thinking about the impact of racism and historical trauma and that impact on the community. ACEs are common, ACEs are highly interrelated, and they have a cumulative impact on the lifelong health and well-being of families and individuals. When we think about the chemical changes that occur and the whole study of epigenetics, which is the interplay of genes with the environment, we know that what happened in my womb is what is influenced by what happened in my mother's, which is influenced by her mother or my grandmother, et cetera, et cetera. There are some studies in Scandinavia that show that the same is true for fathers, that what has happened historically with the grandfather and great-grandfather certainly influences the child in terms of their DNA and genetic makeup. The science of epigenetics is clear about the effect of stress caused by discrimination, not only on parents, but also on the children. It's the decades-long stress of discrimination and othering that's helped to form some of our most stubborn health disparities. In this study specifically, researchers developed a conditioned response to cherry blossoms in mice. The mice continued to exhibit the response two generations later, despite there being no exposure to the stimuli since the grandparents' experience. All is not lost, however. Toxic stress and trauma are not destiny. We see individual, family, and community resilience and support every day. It's not an absolute or an internal trail. In the face of toxic stress, children and families need opportunities to buffer the stress. So if there are stresses in one's life, you need things around you that are going to create a buffer to those stressors. The most important and effective things we can do to promote resilience for children and family include creating opportunities where they can build supportive and nurturing relationships. That provides them a sense of security and develops new skills, social and emotional skills that build our sense of hope and self-efficacy. That helps us to learn how to calm our nervous system. And then it's important that we have an opportunity to engage with community, culture, and faith, things that give us a sense of belonging and provide meaning to our lives. Improvements in the community environment promote relationships, hope, and also reduce our stressors. And it's important that we have economic opportunities that help families prevent or mitigate their toxic stress. Communities need an opportunity to model the sense of hope and self-determination that are critical for healthy development and resilience. The solutions need to be driven by communities. Communities know what their strengths are. They know what they can raise up and how best to provide the support within their communities. The solutions need to be driven by the community, and they can identify what their problems are, their needs are, and how best to create culturally relevant strategies in response to those needs. There are lots of examples within Minnesota that are currently at work. Certainly our goal at MDH is to create the conditions that allow people to be healthy, conditions that assure a healthy start and that set the stage for healthy choices throughout life. That 70% of early deaths are preventable, with the majority, 40% of those are due to behavioral patterns that people engage in to alleviate their stress. The social determinants of health contribute to ACEs and toxic stress, especially for very young children. Yet we spend trillions of dollars on health care and intervention rather than prevention. There are lots of programs throughout Minnesota that are working upstream, that are engaged in the prevention and rather than the downstream efforts. Some examples are mentoring programs. There's a Minnesota Mentor Partnership that supports and improves the quality and sustainability of over 450 mentoring programs throughout the state. The St. Cloud ACES Coalition is a group that specifically, it's a partnership that specifically is looking at addressing ACES within the St. Cloud area. There's Peacemaker Resources, which is a program in Bemidji that engages teachers and students around social and emotional learning. There's Minneapolis Recast, which is a SAMHSA-funded resilience and community after stress and trauma. It's a 5-year grant that supports community-based efforts. There's a Suburban Family Collaborative, which is developing a community resilience plan specifically with grant funding to build support and strength within the community, and specifically looking at the impact of racism on families within their community. The state health department specifically, family home visiting is one of probably the most effective means of mitigating toxic stress. It's a two-generation approach, working with the parents to not only connect them to the resources that might be causing them stressors, but also to provide them with the support that they need to be the parent that they need to be to the child and help them learn the skills or support the skills of serve and return so that they can support their child's brain development. There's a state health department, state community health services advisory committee, children of incarcerated parents work group, a subcommittee that's at work, focusing specifically at looking at what the county role is in working with children of incarcerated parents. Because I mentioned earlier, incarcerated parents are the number one ACE for children across the state of Minnesota. And so they're really trying to lift the voice of these invisible children. There's 37 mental well-being and resilience learning communities. This is a resource for local communities that's facilitated a networking opportunity for families or for neighborhoods, communities to lift up what's working in their community and share that with other communities across the state. And if they think that that might work in their community, they can take that and run with it. Certainly, we focus on making the connections for neighborhoods and belonging, and then our whole emphasis on addressing health equity. And the work that we do around suicide prevention and opioid prevention, growing efforts around the opioid prevention. So lots is being done. It's not a hopeless cause by any means. It is possible to mitigate toxic stress. The best tools that we have now are early detection and prevention. Studies show that when kids receive early high-quality intervention, their brain scans can actually look like the brain scans of kids who have not had the same impact, toxic stress re-impact within their lives. The most important and effective thing that we can do is to promote resilience for children and families, which gives them the opportunity to support, to build supportive and nurturing relationships, to develop the social-emotional skills, and to be engaged in their community, culture, and faith in a way that makes sense for them and their families. That's it. Thank you for the opportunity to present.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Grant. It was a good presentation, but it was so much.
It's a lot of information.
It goes so fast, you know, and it really takes time to really to ingest what we heard or how what it means for us as legislators. Mm-hmm. But I think one of your opening statements, you said what happens in childhood has a lasting impression as to who we are as adults.
Yes.
Right? That's a handful there. That's a lot. And early experiences influence development. Right? And so, you know, we've been talking a lot this session around how we create policies and practice, and maybe looking at evidence-based practices to help influence, or best practice to influence and support our decision-making of how we see creating solutions and moving policies through this body. Would you consider, you know, the ACEs one of those evidence-based practices or one of those best practices that we need and could utilize as we're making decisions around education, as we are making decisions within our Health and Human Service Policy Committee, looking at whether it's mental health or health determinants, you know, what do you think about that?
Madam Chair, absolutely. I think the more that we can all be educated around ACEs and trauma-informed practice, the better our decisions will be. So the more that we understand that what happens early in childhood affects us throughout our lives, absolutely can influence and impact in a significant way, I think, policy development and our program development.
Absolutely. But you also stated that it's not over, right?
Oh,
it doesn't happen, you know, if you're not able to get the concrete support you need, for instance, as a child or as an infant, it's not over. There are some things that we can practically do into the teen years, into adulthood. Could you talk a little bit more about what some of that could be? And you did a little bit, but.
Certainly. Madam Chair, thank you. Well, I think it's really important that we think about building those relationships around parents so that they're supported in a way that they can nurture and bring up their children and reduce the stressors within the home environment. So, again, back to the social determinants. If a family is concerned about housing or food or childcare access, those are things that they're going to spend their time thinking about, and then it takes away from the time that they can engage it with their child. It makes it a lot harder. But that's not all loss, because there can be other adults in that child's life as well. Certainly teachers are important. People within the community, neighbors, there are lots of folks within the community that can also provide that important supportive nurturing relationship that a child is so important for the child. It, parents are the primary, absolutely. But we can build that kind of ecological model where the child and the family are in the center, and then the community is around them, and around them is the society, the larger role. And all of that is, there's an interplay between all of those various factors within an individual's life, most definitely. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but.
Okay, I'm going to open it up to Representative Gruhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Brandt, for your presentation. I do have a little bit of an addendum. You know, I think we do have to look at government and to what degree they have undermined the traditional family in our society through programs like the welfare program, which I think we could all agree that a stable family has a lot to do with the stress on children. And I'll just reference Dr. Walt Williams. He's from George Mason University. And he has an article here that says, and he's a black professor, by the way, he says it's welfare that has decimated the U.S. black family. He goes on to quote a statistic. In 1960, 22% of black children were raised in single-parent families. Today, over 70% of black children are raised in a single family. And obviously, he goes on to show how welfare has been a major cause of undermining the traditional black family. So I agree with a lot of the stress things, but I think we need to look at government and its policies that had contributed to the breakdown of the family in our society. And just one additional note before I ask you for a comment. Obamacare has a marriage penalty in it. If you have two young single people and they each earn about $30,000, they could qualify for a subsidy for the purchase of health care. If they get married rather than just live together, they have to stack their income and they lose that subsidy of about $1,500. Again, that's an example from a couple years ago. I'm sure inflation and other things would modify that. So Obamacare, to a certain degree, has taken the welfare philosophy of undermining the traditional family into the middle class. I could give you several other examples, but don't you agree that we need to look at the policies government promotes that actually undermine the traditional family and is harmful to the children, especially minorities?
Mrs. Brandt.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd want to look at that study. I'm not familiar with it, so I'd like to look at that a little more closely. Do I think government is the only solution? No, but I do think that potentially there's a role. Having come out of local public health, I'm very familiar with families who are just scraping by. And working multiple jobs to keep their families afloat, barely afloat, which is concerning when we're talking about toxic stress factors for children and the inability of parents to have the time that's necessary for the brain development. I think when you're having to work multiple jobs and you come home and you're exhausted or your children are already in bed, it really detracts from the time that a parent can engage with their child, if at all.
Let me also share a little bit in reference to, in response to your question, Representative Gruhagen. You know, welfare plays a role as a safety net to lift up and support families when they are in need. I can say and do believe that it has been government who has, since the inception of bringing African Americans to America and enslaving them, and the intentional removal of a separation of children and families, the intentional incarceration of our African-American men and our fathers, creating process and policies that does not allow the black male to be a part of the household has impact where we are today. it's not necessarily welfare, but it has been the policies and practice of the United States of America in looking at the black family that has really, as we talk about toxic stress, and as we talk about historical trauma, as we talk about ACEs, those are the things from hundreds of years of suppression and racism and that has found itself into our households. So I just wanted to share that because, you know, we have put a safety net in place for a reason, but it has definitely disproportionate and negatively impacted the black family. Representative Gruhage.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Now, Representative Moran, you know how much I like and respect you.
Well.
Okay. So, but I would, you know, I would just add this, that when we look at the breakdown of the family, especially those low-income ones, I do think we have to take into consideration the policies that the government has promoted since initiating the welfare program. One other comment on the presentation, and I'm encouraging members just to do some additional research on their own, okay? Because this, having served on the school board for 16 years, I've spent a lot of time on this, which Representative Erdahl would confirm. There was a person by the name of Dr. John Brewer. He's a professor emeritus on the Early Childhood Family Council with President Clinton.
Representative Gruhagen, we're going to really need, we have like
a, okay, a I'll make it quick. Anyway, he voted against the early childhood recommendations that President Clinton had, and he wrote a book, The Myth of the First 3 Years. And I think there's well-qualified scientists who would contest some of the conclusions that are put forward on some of these government programs in terms of that your life is fixed at 3 years old. So I encourage people to do some additional research. You'll find that there's well-qualified experts that disagree with some of the conclusions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kunis-Podine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony and explaining ACEs so well. I'm a teacher, and there are a number of us here on the committee that are teachers, and we deal with kids that are, you know, deal with trauma daily or are genetically maybe predisposed from that. And a large part of some of our population are kids that are coming from war-torn countries, you know. And I'm wondering if within this ACEs test, is there a question or is there something that can measure the effect of coming from an early age that where the child has experienced some kind of a war-torn situation or genocide or something along those lines?
Mrs. Brandt.
The short answer to that would be no, there really isn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Brandt, for your testimony. Very interesting. We just, some of us here just came from a public safety committee meeting where we talked about incarceration and the impact that it has on families and children. So you mentioned, I think it was on slide six, I think there were two of these slides actually, that incarceration was the number one. So can you describe what you mean by number one? It has the most impact. Is that in DNA? Or, you know, I'm just curious why, what makes it number one?
Mrs. Bryant.
Madam Chair, it's the most reported ACE for kids across the state.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the very, I can't see you over there, but thanks for the very interesting presentation. It is kind of an eye-opener and something that really should inform more of what we do around here. So I had a real kind of a quick question, and then I wanted to just respond briefly on the issue about welfare. But My quick question was on your slide 18, page 18 here, with when you list what is happening. You know, I'm very interested in our Results First program that we're running now, and I'm just wondering, some of these are programs that are out there, but whether a lot of this has been analyzed, or the underlying techniques that they're using have been, to what degree that we've collected evidence around what works and what doesn't work. I mean, this is great to have sort of a list of who's working on these things, but I think it's also going to be important. Like, I know family home visiting is very well studied and very well supported by evidence, but I'm just wondering if the rest of this is.
Mrs. Bright.
Madam Chair, it would vary depending upon the program. Some, there are evidence supported or evidence informed. Some are evidence based. If you'd like, we could probably get you the information as to which ones have what amount of evidence behind them.
Okay, and thanks for that, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I don't need that right now. I'm sure that it's on the website. I just wanted to flag that as being, you know, with this great list, one of the mm-hmm. things Results First is doing is giving us an inventory of what we've got, right? That's yep. great. I just wanted to say briefly, responding to the comments about welfare, we just had a very extensive hearing on our MFIT program, which is Minnesota's welfare program, Minnesota Family Investment. And I'm just really astounded to hear the kind of continued sort of stereotyping of what that is. And I'm awfully glad that Representative Moran kind of referred back to when we talk about what government does. Well, gosh, government's done a lot of different things over the years. And going back, you know, to slavery times, government indeed did some pretty destructive things that are obviously, you know, the results of that may still be with us, and even in a biological way that we're often not aware of. I think that's kind of the point of a lot of what you presented. But our MFIP program, which some would say is undermining the family, I mean, we had a whole presentation about it, and in fact, our MFIP program is barely there as a safety net for low-wage workers in Minnesota. People stay on it an average of 17 months. The amount of money that people get when they're on the program, even that leaves you well below the poverty level. So I don't know how anybody can blame that program, especially having sat through the presentation and listened to what we're talking about and who we're talking about, that this is somehow the problem instead of just a barely adequate way to help those families who are in the deepest trouble. And let's just be honest about it, most of the people that's supporting are kids. So, you know, far from that program hurting people, that program is barely adequate to help people, and we need to help raise up that program so that it actually lifts some of these families more out of poverty so that it can reduce their stress and reduce the damage that we're continuing to do to those children. So thanks for letting me say that, Madam
yes.
Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lieber. Sometimes we need a reminder that government does some really good things and are there for really to help and lift people out of their most difficult times in lives. Chair, you are king.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. Representative Hassan.
I may have just forgot my question, Madam Chair. Representative Kunish Budin's point, I have some stuff about how war trauma impacts children, and I'll send you some stuff. Thank you for this wonderful presentation. I am surprised that there's not a lot of historical trauma mentioned in here. There's only one page. And knowing the history of the United States with the genocide of the Native Americans and the slavery of African Americans, and how society even today, you know, systemic racism and barriers to resources impacts ACES, I would think that you guys would have more on historical trauma. But hopefully there is some in the website.
Mrs. Brandt.
Madam Chair, we can get more information to you with the limited time. It can't cover everything, but absolutely historical trauma is a part of ACEs and certainly what we look at to try and mitigate and make a difference in.
Representative Hur.
Everybody already asked the questions I wanted to and addressed the issues that I really wanted to address, so thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation, Ms. Brandt. I want to go back to the question previously that incarceration was the most reported ACE across the state. I'm wondering, who did you survey for this study? I mean, it seems like when we're talking about addictions and mental health and ineffective schools, I mean, it seems like there are a lot in poverty. It seems like that there are ACEs that would be much more prevalent. So that was a little surprising to me. So I'm just wondering who is included in this survey.
So it would be whoever took the behavioral risk survey in 2011. And that, yeah. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Mrs. Brandt, go ahead.
Madam Chair, it would be whoever responded to the survey at that time. What was striking to me is one out of six children in Minnesota report that they've had a parent who has been incarcerated.
Yeah. In totality?
Even in jail for one day.
Mrs. Brandt, yes.
Pardon? Sorry, Dave was giving the question was
in totality. Yes. Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, we happen to have a, and I think this is just to clarify, Representative New was all, and then we just had a hearing on this in public safety just before now, and what the information that came out is that that's any parent who spent even a day, like overnight in jail at all. So it's not prison necessarily. It's sort of if somebody was spent any time in jail at all, that's what's counting as incarcerated. And so that's all. Just wanted to clarify that for Representative New, Madam Chair.
Representative New.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. That does help. I just think this is really important information, so I appreciate this. So my question is then, who is under? What are the settings in which someone would participate in this survey? Is it somebody receiving mental health services? Is it through schools? Is it just completely self-reported?
Mrs. Brandt,
Madam Chair. It is through schools, Minnesota Student Survey.
Okay. And is
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is that statewide?
Mrs. Brandt.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, school districts have to elect to participate in it. Pretty much across the state, there are a few that opt out, but it's well representative across the state.
And for informational purposes, as I know a little bit about ACEs, but originally ACEs was done in San Diego with 17,000 white middle-class individuals. It's where it's
not
originally came from, right? 17,000 white middle-class individuals, right? And what they found, there was a common theme about the ACEs that continued to show up in their lives. Even the middle-class family who did well off had ACEs. I would also like to invite everyone. You have in front of you some Minnesota ACE questions, which is you can also take an ACE, I don't want to call it a test, but you can take an ACE questionnaire to find out whether or not you have any ACEs that show up in your lives. You know, we are all a product of our childhood, you know, and we really make decisions based on how we was raised, where we came from, and how that childhood presented itself. And then we become those adults, right? You have populations of people who have had different types of ACEs that have popped up, whether it's a parent who was incarcerated, whether there's violence in the community, whether there was, abuse in the home, alcoholism in the home, all those forms ACEs, right? And that impacts our lives as little kids. We grow up into adults. We might become alcoholics ourselves. You know, we might become what we was a part of. If it was balanced in the home, you know, we become violent also. So that's kind of like what ACEs are and how they show up.
Sure. So this will be my last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my last question is, thank you. So for this purpose, just to make sure I understand, this really, the ACE questions are really just about gathering very raw data. This is not necessarily that any, like I said, that's why I was wondering if they were administered to kids who are receiving mental health treatment. So this is not necessarily kids who are exhibiting more obvious effects of trauma. This is every kid across the board, minus those districts that opt out of ACEs.
Mrs. Brandt.
Madam Chair, Representatives, yes, that would be true. I'd have to follow up for sure. I don't know if in this particular, they have, the Minnesota Student Survey, they've done, specifically done some outreach to, like, alternative high schools. So kids who have probably had pretty traumatic histories participate as well.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brandt, I'm looking at the, in brief, the foundations of lifelong health. Just wanted to have a little conversation. I'm really intrigued by the interplay between the development hierarchy, if you will, here, and I draw your attention to a couple of in category one and category number two. I'm a fan of food. Confession time. So help me to appreciate and further understand. I think I know how, what, but one of the comments here is appropriate nutrition. But in the first one, you also use about physiological adaptations or disruptions. And there's an interplay between physiological development and proper nutrition. So I'm wondering if, first and foremost, how that either assuages someone from falling into further fits of trauma, or it stabilizes the person as they try to regain their footing, if you will. So how does physiological nutritional consistency work in this paradigm?
Mrs. Brandt.
Madam Chair, Representative. So certainly good nutrition is important for health and physical health and development and our brain development as well. But there's no one thing that would mitigate it alone by any stretch. So good nutrition alone isn't going to be enough to mitigate toxic stress. And one could probably argue that for people who have toxic stress, food scarcity is an issue. Very often they live in food deserts, and so good nutrition is a little harder for them to come by. And so, again, it's one more issue that feeds into the development or the difficulty in mitigating the stress, the toxic stress. And if you don't have that healthy food available to you, it's kind of one more strike. Is that answering your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Just a quick follow-up.
All right. Representative Albright.
So nutrition starts as early as possible, understanding that. But is there a point at which you've observed that it's more important than others?
Mrs. Brandt.
Madam Chair, I would say no.
Okay, so this is what I would like to do. Are you able to stay around?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so because this is a joint hearing, and we definitely want to allow time for Education Minnesota to present around education, around ACEs and education, I think we should do that. So I'm going to just close it out with allowing Chair Joaquin to ask a question or make a statement, and then we're going to move it on.
I've got one quick question for you. It's a follow-up on Representative Kunesh-Podein's question. When I did our ACEs training, there was discussion, too. I noticed on your test it's the Minnesota ACEs test. Mm-hmm. How often is that adjusted? Because there really should – and who does the adjusting? Because there really should be some discussion around adding in that question about – the kiddos coming from more traumatic situations, because that's reflective of the children in our schools. So who does it, and how often do we modify it? Ms. Brandt.
Madam Chair, it's done, the student survey is done every 3 years. Is that correct? Yes, it's done every 3 years. The ACEs specific questions were only done that one time. Could we do those again? Absolutely. We'd have to work with the Department of Education to integrate some new questions. But could that happen? I don't know why not.
Wonderful. Well, that is a great segue into – Chair Moran?
So I just want to let Representative Pinto, Bennett, and Erdahl know that you're on the list, and you'll be the first to be called.
Okay.
Thank you. My, Madam Chair, was just clarifying for Representative New, so I'll pass.
Okay, good. So rolling into the education piece and what we were just talking about is, especially with the Minnesota Student Survey, it's a really good reflection of the kids that are in our school today and the barriers that they bring with when they go to learning. And I know the education folks, we had the Bar Center in, and they talk about 40 developmental assets, and I think those kind of dovetail on that strategy of the support network around kids to help them get through these ACEs, the issues with around ACEs and brain development. So thank you, Ms. Brandt. And I'm going to bring down our next testifiers. And we have Greta Callahan from the Minneapolis Public Schools. She's a teacher. And Michelle Vieira Kaleni, and they're going to have to pronounce their names for me right because I'm sure I'm butchering them, from the St. Paul Public Schools, and she's a social worker. And they're both going to give us insights on students with high ACE scores and how they present in the classroom and some of the things that they're doing. And if you want to go ahead and sit down, state your name for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Greta Callahan. Michelle Vieira Kaleni.
Thank you so much. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. My name is Greta Callahan. I've been a kindergarten teacher with Minneapolis Public Schools for 6 years, and I taught in a charter school 2 years prior to that. I am an expert at integrating the arts into core subject areas. I have done academic research into the best ways to reduce traumatic triggers in the classroom. And in 2017, I was a finalist for Minnesota Teacher of the Year. I'm going to share 4 short stories about what happens when schools lack the policies and resources needed to educate children for processing past traumatic events in their lives. Although my personal experience is limited to schools in Minneapolis, my conversations with other teachers suggest you could hear similar stories from educators throughout Minnesota. However, you might not hear them from teachers in charter schools. Before moving to MPS, the administrators at my charter school advised us to handle students with extreme behaviors by persuading their parents to withdraw them from our school and to attend the public school. I assure you that all of the following stories about students I have taught are true, but I have changed the names and the dates in order to protect their privacy. Take Darren. I communicated with his parents on a daily basis, but we still don't know what happened to him or why he was angry and sad. The smallest things would set him off, and his outbursts shut down our classroom. Something as simple as not being line leader that day would trigger him, or another student would say something, and suddenly he would scream swear words at me, throw chairs, flip tables. When I would evacuate the children from the classroom for their safety, he would smash his face on the ground until he bled. Imagine the learning time lost when these situations occur. Now imagine them occurring multiple times throughout each day. Keep in mind the rest of the class is watching and observing as I try to get everyone back on task. Another student dear to my heart is Tanya. She started the year as a teacher's dream. Reading at a second grade level, she loved coming to school. And one day, her little sister died in a freak accident during a tonsillectomy. I was very close to this family because I had taught several of her siblings. After the accident, I saw her mom die inside. And my little girl changed too. Just a word like sister or doctor or a pretty song would trigger the memory of losing her sibling. She would get so angry and violent towards me or other students, or she would just shut down completely, refusing to speak or even go to lunch or recess. Meanwhile, my formal training involves lesson planning and saying things like crisscross applesauce. Annette's trauma displayed itself differently. I'll never forget the first day of kindergarten. She refused to enter the classroom. She was not afraid or nervous. She was furious. She stood by the door, refusing to enter, mouth closed, breathing heavily through her nose. clenched fists and a blank stare. 30 minutes later, I coaxed her to the back of the room so that she could eat. I assured her that she could stay at that table for as long as she wanted. The first day of kindergarten, which should be filled with joy and hope for the future, was something that little girl was never able to feel because of a prior traumatic educational experience she had. This happened every day for months, and she refused to speak until later in the year. One of the hardest stories to share is about one of my little girls who was placed in foster care because she was sexually assaulted by family members. And then she was abused in her temporary foster home. County officials knew they were trying to help, but the bureaucracy moved slowly. And every day she came in, I held her as she sobbed, or I would let her go sleep in a cozy chair in the back of the room, clutching the Dora doll I bought her for her birthday because literally no one else knew she had turned 6. I could tell countless stories about innocent children with unlimited potential who have suffered horrifying trauma. My colleagues and I are doing everything we can. We are at all moments of the day aware of 20-plus personalities, interactions, and reactions as we attempt fantastic lessons, because at the end of it all, we are educators. I reduced the number of triggers in my classroom by posting a sign on the classroom door so guests now know the protocols when they enter. I integrate the arts and tailor learning to individual needs. I have my students express themselves through play, song, dance, and heavily focus on social-emotional learning. I allow unsanctioned naps and snuggle time in a comfy chair. My assistant and I are hyper-aware of everything happening below the surface and try to move ahead of the storm that can plunder our classroom at any given moment. My very experienced assistant takes students for walks in the hallway before issues even arise, and we try to read our kids as we greet them at the lockers each morning. But that's not nearly enough. Our students need and deserve more. It is time for the state to require every educator in Minnesota to receive training in how to educate students with trauma. You will often hear this described as trauma-informed teaching. The other thing educators need from the legislator is simple: money. The needs of the students we educate are changing, and our system for funding schools must change with them. The state needs to supply trauma-informed training for teachers, support professionals, special education assistants, local administrators, and district officials. We need more interventions at home for children age 0 to 3, when so much of this trauma is first experienced. Age 5 is too late to start dealing with it. Every school like mine needs a trauma coach. Yes, that's a thing. It's like a mentor for the staff and kids with trauma, who is always there in the building and whose students know. We need 2 qualified adults in every single classroom like mine. I am so fortunate to have an excellent aide, Ms. Tequila, but many teachers are not so lucky, and I wasn't always so lucky. Our schools also need more social workers, school psychologists, and at least 1 full-time nurse in every building. Educating students with trauma is unfortunately the new normal in Minnesota schools. I am often on the receiving end of profanity, thrown chairs, punches, while simultaneously students are running up to me, hugging me, and asking me questions. The former behavior has become normalized, and we need help in order for this to change. Teaching is an act of service, whether people like that term or not. I want to watch my students grow, learn, find, and keep joy, and flourish as human beings. I also want my students and colleagues to feel safe, both emotionally and physically. I am here pleading for help, because we are losing fantastic educators each year who go into work every day feeling powerless and voiceless. All of the actions I described above from my kids, those are cries for help, 4 different cries for help. And that is exactly what I am doing here today. I am screaming for not just awareness, but action. I did not go into teaching to watch the system around me suffocate and silence us all because we won't provide the funding to adequately serve our kids. I came here to disrupt that system for my students. I feel no one is listening and our world is suffering. I ask you, is my work worth it? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Callahan. Ms. Vieira Kalani?
Good afternoon. I'm the lead.
Could you please state your name for the record one more time and where you work?
Yeah. My name is Michelle Vieira Kalani, and I'm the lead school social worker for St. Paul Public Schools.
Thank you.
I am trained as a clinical social worker. I have worked as an in-home therapist and as well as a school-based mental health provider. I am here today to speak to you about the work we have done to implement a trauma-informed school approach. Research shows us that traumatic childhood incidents as abuse, neglect, witnessing crime, parental conflict, mental illness, and substance abuse can create dangerous levels of stress and derail healthy brain development. This can result in long-term effects on learning, behavior, and health. Children that have experienced trauma, ACEs, can display symptoms that may interfere with learning, such as hypervigilance, difficulty trusting others, emotional dysregulation, and other internalizing behaviors. Trauma-informed care is an approach that recognizes the presence of these traumatic symptoms and responds by creating safe, supportive environments where students can develop positive relationships with adults. Trauma-informed care should be seen as a universal precaution used for all students. We may not know exactly who has been affected by trauma, nor should we make assumptions about specific groups of people based on culture, income, gender, sexual orientation, or ability. Trauma-informed care is not about diagnosing or labeling students. All students need consistent environments that emphasize empowerment, trustworthiness, safety, collaboration, and choice. By being aware and mindful of the effects of trauma, educators can break the cycle of trauma, prevent re-traumatization, and engage a child in learning. By using a trauma-informed schools approach, the St. Paul Public Schools Social Work Department has provided educators with practical strategies as well as the background knowledge they need to build and strengthen relationships with students, one of the key concepts of trauma-informed care. We delve deeper into topics such as trauma in the brain, historical and social trauma, resilience, attunement, self-regulation, empowerment, restorative practices, and self-care for staff. 9 of our schools have a halftime trauma coach who focuses on increasing staff understanding of trauma. St. Paul Public Schools social workers participate in trauma-informed personal learning communities where they learn, collaborate, measure progress, and then take that with them to their buildings to educate their school staff through professional development. Professional development for all staff, teachers, administrators, paraprofessionals, bus drivers, custodians, and nutrition services staff. We have also collaborated with other departments to provide district-wide supports. We created an increasing wellness and decreasing toxic stress Schoology video, which was required for all licensed staff. We have screened the Paper Tigers documentary throughout the district and provided professional development. We recently presented at the superintendent's quarterly meeting to all principals and supervisors in the district on the effects of secondary and vicarious trauma. School social workers from Bruce Bento Elementary provided an intro to trauma course for all St. Paul Public Schools bus drivers. As for what we have seen as a result of this work, it's immeasurable. I can tell you that before beginning this work, I myself was one of the trauma coaches that I mentioned earlier. I still receive messages from coworkers telling me that something they learned in a training I provided sparked a change in the way that they respond to students. One of my former colleagues told me about a situation where she was working with a student on a specific academic task. The student was having difficulty engaging in the activity and seemed really distracted. She tried harder, more forcefully, to engage him in the task. The student then got up and hid behind a bookshelf, refusing to get up. She said she felt out of control of the situation and began to get more forceful with the student, using a firmer, louder tone of voice. She then remembered what I said. Students need to feel safe to learn. Dysregulated brains can't learn. She got down on her knees and whispered to the student, "You must feel really safe in there, huh?" The child nodded yes. She then sat on the floor with him and supported him through that moment. Eventually, the child came out, and it was time for them to move on to something else. In recalling the event, she said to me, "Michelle, before learning about trauma, I would have gotten into a power struggle with that student and possibly escalated into something more severe. I would have gone home beating myself up over how I didn't get through that math lesson with that student. Instead, I went home thinking how much more connected to that student I felt. And I was proud of myself for taking the time to make our relationship stronger because I knew the payoff would be that much greater in the long run. We ask our educators and school staff to do better with less, to do more, but we don't take the time to give them the tools they need to do it. We don't talk to them about self-care and how working under that stress and with students can lead them to not taking care of themselves, which can then lead to things such as vicarious trauma, secondary trauma, compassion fatigue, or burnout. We don't talk to them about how some of those behaviors we see in students are actually trauma triggers and not personal attacks or defiance. We need to create a sense of urgency around this issue. Our students are struggling, and we have the ability to create beautiful, powerful relationships with them and foster resilience. Until we do so, many schools will continue to misinterpret trauma triggers and continue to use exclusionary measures that only push our students farther and farther away from us and from reaching their full potential. This work does not require purchasing a specific curriculum or one specific training. What we have done in St. Paul Public Schools is increase our internal capacity to implement these practices. What is needed is more of us. We need more school social workers. Because of our expertise in mental health, we have the ability to be leaders in this work. In addition, we need counselors and psychologists so that we can all support school staff in learning and growing in this area. Staff who can support educators when they feel they have run out of ideas of how to help a student. While these practices can be accomplished without the addition of a lot of staff, smaller sizes, class sizes, and more paraprofessionals would ease the burden on teachers and allow them to be more attuned with their students. We need more support so that we can increase our work with parents and engaging our community around trauma. Becoming trauma-informed is a process. It is not a destination. It requires constant reflection and practice. As adults, we revert to what feels comfortable, and often those are strategies that engage us to have power over and control over our students, rather than power with our students. We need time with staff to provide them with training and provide them with tools. We have found it challenging to find time for professional development. Lastly, we need your support in making large system change that supports us in this process. We need this to be an expectation for all schools in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vieira-Tolaney. I want to open up to questions, and I had Representative Erdahl on the list from previously. So do you have a question for teachers or comment? Should maybe not open it up to comments. Question, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question of Ms. Brandt was, when is the testing done? I mean, is it when they receive the survey, what grades are they in? Is it repeated? Do they get it more than once?
Maybe we'll have Ms. Brandt come down and quick answer that question, but if you could still remain too, because I want to make sure folks have time to ask the teachers questions as well. And then up on deck is Representative Bennett. Was your question to Ms. Brandt as well? Okay.
It's the school questions. Survey that I'm talking about.
Representative Ms. Bennett. Brandt, do you have a question?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's done in grades 5, 8, 11, 9, and 11.
Okay. And Representative Bennett? Oh, Representative Erdahl, did you have a follow-up?
Yes. So that then if someone took it in grade 5, they could take it again when they're in 11th grade. And then one more for the other two.
Yes.
And thank you for your, you know, very moving testimony. The para increasing, I think you mentioned two per teacher. In what grades would that be? Or, I mean, through the whole system? Or
Ms. Callahan or Ms. Vieira Kalani, whoever wants to answer that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I did say that. And my experience is pre-K through 5, and I can tell you that we absolutely would benefit having two adults in every single one of those classrooms. I used to not have a second adult. I used to have 27 kids at my same school without a second adult, and something as simple as having someone there to just care when you walk in the door, who can tie your shoe, check in with you, because as you can imagine from those stories, which are not my most extreme cases, there are a lot of cries for help throughout the day, and we do need two qualified human beings to help everyone in the classroom and to get us through to the end goal, which is to learn.
And Ms. Callan, I think you mean along with the teacher, another para, because not
every yes, I'm sorry, not too
yes,
extra.
Not every one of our classrooms have a para. The school I was just working in this fall, only our kindergarten rooms had a para with. So you're saying it'd be nice to have an extra set of hands in each of the classrooms.
Yeah, in schools like mine. I don't know if that's the case for every school, but
having been in other schools, I would say yes.
Madam Chair,
the other teachers
just
around here. Quick follow-up, and then we'll
thank
some more
you.
Folks on the list.
Just wanted to either of you or ever feel for your own safety. Is this a concern? A concern of teachers and
Ms. Callahan, Ms.
Yeah, every day.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is for Ms. Brandt. This is very, very interesting from everybody. But Ms. Brandt, just I'm curious, on page 18 where it talks about what works, what is happening, it lists various programs. I'm just curious, are these all government programs? And if they are there private or nonprofit programs that are working too, or even societal institutions such as religion? Has there been any study on those things working?
Ms. Grant.
Madam Chair, Representative. It's a mixture of, it's not all government programs. It's a mixture of government, community-based, nonprofit. It's a school-based. It's an assortment of programs.
Thank you. Chair Moran.
Thank you, Chair Joaquin. One of the things that I have learned from the purpose of, you know, just been recognizing what ACEs is and creating trauma-informed policies and practices is that often, even within our school system, we sometimes see kids who come in with these behaviors. And if you're not trauma-informed, the first thing you may say to these kids is like, you know, what is wrong with you, right? And then we react in that type of way, which is a very, as you talked about, I get control, you need to, you know. And so, but once you are trauma-informed, the question is not what is wrong with you. It's like what is happening to you or what happened to you. And then you begin to respond differently. You have some different tools as a teacher in your toolbox, you know, where you are allowing that child, because you are aware that, you know, maybe you need to lower your voice. Maybe you need to allow them the time to, you know, have some space. And so my hope is that, you know, or trauma-informed, I was going to ask you, what did that look like? If you're not trauma-informed, and if you are, you know, is it versus, you know, someone who come in and they're throwing chairs and you're like, you're suspended, you're out of here? Or is it more than we're going to create a comfort room where you can go and just run or do whatever you need to do because we understand that something is happening in your life, right? So can you give us some examples of, you know, being trauma-informed versus not having that training and how you react and how you respond to children in the classroom?
Ms. Fiona Kalani, I know you had a good example in your presentation too, but you have something to add?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, So it can range from things, you know, for trauma-informed schools, we really look at everything from the way that we respond to students when they're dysregulated to things that can also be triggering, such as where is that student seated? If that student has experienced a particular trauma, do they feel more comfortable being seated by the door so that they can be aware of what adults are coming into the room? We look at things like lighting, spaces in our buildings that can kind of make things really loud and feel kind of chaotic. So the lunchrooms, we try and look at ways that we can kind of ease that sensory overwhelm. And in a school where perhaps they are not trauma-informed, we're looking at, as you said, a different belief system about where the behavior is coming from, less tolerance for disruption, perhaps, you know, not inquiring, asking questions of the student, making assumptions, and then moving forward from there.
Thank you, Representative Chair Moran.
Yes, so I just, when we look at, even within our Health and Human Service, for those who are on Health and Human Service Policy Committee, you know, let's just take another look at what is working as we look at solutions here and what we're going to find and what makes sense, you know, whether or not, you know, we're looking at learning or behavior health or mental conditions, you know, conditions, knowing that even in the midst of what kids are challenged with, they are resilient. It's not the end of the world, right? And they can bounce back. But also, it's some self-regulation, so giving people the opportunity to self-regulate. And for us, that can look like, you know, we have a high rate of incarceration. And, you know, are we getting to the issue of the problem by just finding that instead of being the solution? Or are we more upfront in supporting communities and families and finding a different model to do the work that needs to do for the results that we want and not put that burden on the state to continue to do the same thing over with and we don't have the results that we need to really, in my people really want to be able to take care of themselves and their families. They want to live in their community. They want to do well in school, you know, but it's costing like us how much money to keep doing the same thing and not getting the results. And then on top of that, we continue to increase the disparities.
I see your hand, Representative Grunhagen, but I've got Representative Fisher on the list. We only have 4 minutes left. I'm wondering if you can ask yours offline because we still have announcements, too. So I want to give folks a chance that haven't asked a question. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I want to say thank you to the teachers for coming in and sharing their stories today. Very much appreciate it. And I'm really heartened by the embracing of the trauma-informed care and the hard work that you folks are doing out there. I know it's not easy. My regular job, I work at a homeless youth shelter in North Minneapolis. I've been doing that for almost 12 years now. So I get to see the other side of it. And one of the things that I'm enheartened by both committees coming together so often, I see the problems that we're probably having in the schools so often is tied into what is not happening or the lack of support in the Health and Human Services side. We have to start taking a look at a more of a holistic approach because you folks are just triaging the things that are happening out in society that we need to have a stronger support network out there to make sure that kids are coming out of stable homes, that they've got food on a regular, reliable basis, things that sometimes we're not always implementing and carrying out as a society. And once we start addressing those issues, your jobs become much more easier, and then the kids are able to be much more effective in learning. So I want to say thank you to the chairs for bringing both committees together so that we start looking at this in a holistic way, because in my opinion, from what I've seen, that's the only way we're going to start making progress is to take a look at the whole picture and work across silos instead of staying siloed as we have in the past. Thank you.
Representative Fisher, you actually summed up what I was going to say, so thank you very much. I want to thank the testifiers all for coming. I know folks still had questions. I'm sorry an hour and a half goes so fast. I'm sure folks will stay a little bit, but we might have to move out to the hallway because I think someone's in here at 4:15. I want to thank Representative Moran for being willing to have this. And it was funny because we were both thinking of having a hearing and started to talk and went, why don't we do it together? But I know you have an announcement and I have an announcement, and then
So for the Health and Human Service Policy Committee, we are, as a reminder, we are meeting on Monday, February the 11th. Yes, Monday. Did I hear him? February 11th at 12:45 p.m., and we will hear several long-term care bills on Monday.
Wonderful, thank you. And then next room 200. Yes. Next Education Committee is going to be back in our old room on Tuesday, February 12th. So State Office Building Room 5, regular time, 2:30 to 4. We're going to have a presentation on the education standards and a few bills. So with that, we're adjourned.